You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the 31st of July to the 6th of August 2014. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporter Holly Else, deputy news editor John Morgan, books editor Karen Shook and writer Matthew Rice. An explosion in the popularity of integrated bachelor's and master's degrees is the subject of this week's lead news story. Find out why these courses are proving so popular in a few moments' time. Whistleblowing, when a worker reports suspected wrongdoing in their workplace, happens in universities as it does in many walks of life. But what happens to academics who have raised concerns in their institutions? Does it have a long-term impact on their careers? That's the topic of this week's cover feature. John will tell us more on that in a second. Karen's here to give us our regular rundown of the THE book section before Matthew Rice tells us a little bit more about his feature this week, an interview with a literary scholar whose research on jihadist poetry took her from Oxford to Yemen, where she was welcomed by armed tribal leaders. More on that soon. But first, Holly, people are increasingly opting for combined bachelor's and master's courses, according to your splash this week. How do they work?
Well, these are four-year courses which integrate bachelor's level study with master's level study. And they're extremely popular in the sciences and engineering, particularly because they offer students the chance to get a master's and for engineering. If you want to become a chartered engineer, that's really important. And the reason they've been developed is really to try and offer a way for students to get more laboratory work or practical work to then go on and work in those industries.
And he's a figure that suggests they've become a lot more popular in the last few years. Why is that?
Yeah, so there's been a doubling of the amount of students taking these courses in the last 5 years. And the people that we spoke to about this seem to all think that this was to do with the fact that you could get student loans funding to do what's essentially a master's level qualification. Whereas if you wanted to do a postgraduate master's after you've graduated, you would have to find private sources of finance for that, so either yourself or from a bank. So it really offers students the opportunity to do that without having to rely on their own money or go to a bank, which has a much higher interest rate than a student loan.
And are they widely available? Are they only in certain institutions?
They're pretty widely available, yeah. And actually what's interesting about this piece is looking at the different subjects they're available in. So although I said they're typically in science subjects, there are more and more courses now in arts and humanities type subjects. Different universities decide to offer this as a way for students to get a master's qualification. But there are concerns in terms of how they fit in with the rest of Europe. So, for example, if you wanted to go on and do a PhD after doing an integrated master's in the UK, in the rest of Europe, you might be competing against students who have a standalone master's qualification. And in those countries, they might not actually know what an integrated master's actually is. So it could cause some problems.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Well, the full story is on page 6 and 7, I believe, this week. Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong. No, it seems to be right, so do check that out there. The cover feature this week is all about whistleblowing. Edward Snowden and the NSA, Christophe Basson, who took on Lance Armstrong. There's many to choose on, but what about in academia, John?
Well, I spoke to three prominent whistleblowers in higher education who all hit national newspaper headlines at the time they came forward about the cases they raised. And the picture they painted was pretty bleak. None of the three are in work in higher education at the moment. They never found full-time jobs after coming forward to talk about the wrongdoing that they found. In one case, That's because the person no longer wanted to work in their field anymore because they felt their senior managers behaved so appallingly in the case. And in two cases, that's the people are saying that they've applied for scores of jobs, but they get shortlisted and never get an interview, or they just don't get the job. And their feeling is that they've been sort of effectively blackballed from ever working in universities again, because they argue that higher education is a very, very small network, and people are linked together, and it's it's an effective process of them now being marked down as not people that universities would want to employ.
And are their names explicitly linked with these blown whistles, or is it that network of rumour that has identified them as being the whistleblower?
Well, I mean, the people I spoke to, Paul Buckland, who is a professor at Bournemouth University, and he raised, he failed quite a high number of papers in one exam, and they were remarked against his wishes, and he came forward about this. And then one of the other people I spoke to is Harinder Bara, who worked at the then Southampton Institute and sort of raised a concern about the use of Hefke funds, and subsequently ended up bringing a tribunal case for race discrimination against his institution. And in both cases, there were cases reported in Times Higher and in national papers. So, you know, it's what Harinder Bara said is, it's, you type his name into Google and it comes up about him settling a race tribunal claim with Brunel University. So he's saying that it's, you know, it's very easy to see his past history, and universities are extremely sort of reluctant to employ him, he believes. And Paul Buckland would be the same. He's been featured in the national newspapers as well. This is inevitably slightly one-sided, perhaps. These are cases where things have gone wrong. I also spoke to David Lewis, who's a professor at Middlesex University who studies whistleblowing, and he pointed out that the nature of successful whistleblowing means that it stays hidden. The universities act on the person's complaint, and it's resolved, and the person carries on in their employment, and we never hear about it outside. So it may be the case that there's a lot of positives to balance out the negative stories in these cases.
The Quality Assurance Agency has a concerns process as well, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's probably for slightly lower scale cases than whistleblowing. That's about concerns about academic quality, and people can raise concerns anonymously through this scheme. But the figures that the QAA provided, it was, I think, over 100 concerns have been raised last year, only 2 full-scale inquiries, so that's not a particularly high hit rate.
Indeed. Well, I hope your piece doesn't put academics off contacting the THE when they have concerns that they wish to raise as well. However, fascinating read. Do check it out. Karen, you're here every couple of weeks, and this is one of those weeks. What's in the book section for our readers to enjoy?
Inevitably, I have to claim that there is a bumper crop. There's a bumper crop this week.
I always wonder which phrase you're going to come with to introduce each week.
A plethora of volumes.
Oh, you've used next week's now.
Darn. Robert Eaglestone reviews the novel, A Biography, by Michael Schmidt, who is an impressive figure in contemporary British and world literature, and indeed someone who taught at Robert Eaglestone's university when he took his first degree, and friends who studied with him were awestruck. Robert has got over his undergraduate awestruckedness in order to review this book, and says it is the first major work on the subject for a post-Wikipedia age. It's 1,200 pages long. So,
right.
And he claims that it is actually just reproduced the entire content of Wikipedia, are, of course, entirely inaccurate. Tara Brabazon reviews The War on Learning, Gaining Ground in the Digital University by Elizabeth Losch, one of a number of books in the past years that have looked at how learning changes in the digital environment. Tara points out again, as she has elsewhere and in her own books, that a lot of the issues that are being discussed are not specific to the digital environment. And in fact, if you look back at Stanley Aronowitz's The Knowledge Factory, or indeed Lord of the Flies, you'll see a lot of these issues being raised there. Also, Kristen Aun from the University of Derby reviews Belief Without Borders, which is a book that subtitle says, Inside the Minds of the Spiritual But Not Religious. Everybody's run into someone who says, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious, in person as well as in the pages of Hello magazine. This book by Linda Mercadante is a study of what those people believe and what the commonalities are. Our book of the week this week is by Andrew Gamble, professor of politics at Queen's College, Cambridge, reviewed by Vera Traeger at the University of Warwick. She's a professor of quantitative political economy. He is a professor of politics, slightly different camps. She gives him pretty good marks, actually, for someone from the other side. This is a follow-up to his book from 2009, The Spectre at the Feast, Capitalist Crisis and the Politics of Recession. And this book, Crisis Without End, question mark, of course, does have its gloomy shades, as our reviewer says. Anyone who is looking at this part of our recent history would be forgiven for being a little bit negative. His main question is, she says, how has the neoliberal order proved to be so resilient, and can it continue to renew itself? But she says that commendably, he doesn't use the word neoliberal as a kind of placeholder bogeyman for all that is wrong. And Gamble himself, when I spoke to him, I asked him if, you know, there's any reasons to be positive about what has happened since 2008, perhaps since he considered it with his previous book, is that he thinks the spell of neoliberalism has been broken, and there are signs of new thinking, and even the emergence of some alternatives to current orthodoxies. So there are grounds for hope, he says.
Very, very good. Thank you. You mentioned Robert Eagleston there. Of course, he did a books podcast for us earlier. You'll find that on the archive of podcasts online. You mentioned Tara Brabazon, if you're interested in the THE's multimedia output, which if you're listening to this, you might be. She answered a lot of PhD students' questions in her PhD surgery, which is still up on our website, available. If you search there for that and for Tara's name, you'll find lots of lovely articles written by her as well. Moving on though today, Matthew, finally, your latest feature is part of our Outer Limits series, which looks at research outside the comfort zone. This time it's jihadist poetry. Tell us more.
Well, Elizabeth Kendall, who's an expert on Arabic, and she was doing research on a sort of school of modernist poetry in Egypt, quite obscure and not particularly well known. And she got more and more interested in trying to write about poetry and literature and in relation to current concerns and politics. And she got very interested in the jihadist poetry, Al-Qaeda poetry. And for various reasons thought a good place to study it was in Yemen, not actually in the heartlands of where this poetry is produced, because it's probably not terribly safe, but nearby. And so actually she then got very involved with the particular tribal group in the Mahdi areas of eastern Yemen. And they got her to carry out surveys and a poll and in some sense, put their case to international organisations. The research is very interesting, but it involved her going to meetings to address the assembled tribal groupings with, you know, two Land Rovers in front of her, two behind. She says arriving at the meeting, it was a bit like in the Asterix books where they adopt the turtle formation. Mm-hmm. So that if anyone had tried to shoot at her, they would have had to sort of shoot through vast groups of other bodies. And of course, there the additional problems of the gender relations are rather different in Yemen than they are in Oxford, of course. And it's taken many, many visits before, you know, people are even willing to shake hands with her. More and more people, of course, she's got to know them more and more, and more and more of them are willing to shake hands with her each time. And she can take, you know, slightly cake gloves off to eat rice and camel in the desert. And this was quite took quite a lot of discussion and so on. So it's a very, very strange kind of process, the actual research.
And she goes under another name as well.
Elizabeth isn't an Islamic name, so they gave nicknamed her Doctora Aisha. I think this was something she decided on, but that's now what she's called in Eastern Yemen. So a pretty interesting story and some rather fantastic pictures she came back with too.
Yeah, it's wonderfully illustrated as ever. Yeah, page 38 for that this week. That's all for the THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed, or indeed anything in the magazine, you can do so at timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on LinkedIn, on Google+, all of the usual outlets. So if you've got anything you'd like to say, please do get in touch. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.